Bet365 is paying out before the final whistle.
Check out Bet365's unrivaled early payout offer. When you bet on a team to win and they take a 17-point lead, you get paid no matter the final score. Forget the final whistle and start counting that cash. Hold up. You get early payout on parlays, too.
Download the app and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. T&Cs apply.
It's Kelly Clarkson here to talk all things Wayfair, the best place to buy furniture, decor, and anything else you can think of to create a home you absolutely love. I know when I shop with Wayfair, I find options for every style, whether I'm feeling boho or farmhouse, modern, traditional, French country. I can find exactly what I need for my home and more. No matter your space, style, or budget, shop Wayfair.com to make your home way more you.
Wayfair, every style, every home.
Chapter 16 of The Eye of Osiris by R. Austin Freeman. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. O Artemidorus, farewell. Whether or not Mr. Jellicoe was surprised to see us, it is impossible to say. His countenance, which served the ordinary purposes of a face, inasmuch as it contained the principal organs of special sense, with inlets to the elementary and respiratory tracts, was, as an apparatus for the expression of the emotions, a total failure. To a thought reader, it would have been about as helpful as the face carved upon the handle of an umbrella, a comparison suggested perhaps by a certain resemblance to such an object. He advanced, holding open his notebook and pencil, and having saluted us with a stiff bow and an old-fashioned flourish of his hat, shook hands dramatically and waited for us to speak. "This is an unexpected pleasure, Mr. Jellicoe," said Miss Bellingham. "It is very good of you to say so," he replied. "And quite a coincidence that we should all happen to come here on the same day." "A coincidence, certainly," he admitted, "and if we had all happened not to come, which must have occurred frequently, that also would have been a coincidence." "I suppose it would," said she, "but I hope we are not interrupting you." "Thank you, no. I had just finished when I had the pleasure of perceiving you." "You were making some notes in reference to the case, I imagine," said I. It was an impertinent question, put with malice aforethought for the mere pleasure of hearing him evade it. "The case?" he repeated. "You are referring perhaps to Stevens versus the parish council?" "I think Dr. Berkeley was referring to the case of my uncle's will," Miss Bellingham said quite gravely, though with a suspicious dimpling about the corners of her mouth. "Indeed," said Mr. Jellicoe. "There is a case, is there? A suit?" "I mean the proceedings instituted by Mr. Hurst." "Oh, but that was merely an application to the court, and is moreover finished and done with. At least so I understand. I speak, of course, subject to correction. I am not acting for Mr. Hurst, you will be pleased to remember. As a matter of fact," he continued after a brief pause, "I was just refreshing my memory as to the wording of the inscriptions on these stones, especially that of your grandfather, Francis Bellingham. It has occurred to me that if it should appear by the finding of the coroner's jury that your uncle is deceased, it would be proper and decorous that some memorial should be placed here. But as the burial ground is closed, there might be some difficulty about erecting a new monument, whereas there would probably be none in adding an inscription to one already existing. Hence these investigations. For if the inscriptions on your grandfather's stone had set forth that here rests the body of Francis Bellingham, it would have been manifestly improper to add also that of John Bellingham, son of the above. Fortunately, the inscription was more discreetly drafted, merely recording the fact that this monument is sacred to the memory of the said Francis, and not committing itself as to the whereabouts of the remains. But perhaps I am interrupting you." "No, not at all," replied Miss Bellingham, which was grossly untrue. He was interrupting me most intolerably. "We were going to the British Museum and just looked in here on our way." "Ha," said Mr. Jellicoe. "Now, I happen to be going to the museum, too, to see Dr. Norbury. I suppose that is another coincidence?" "Certainly it is," Miss Bellingham replied, and then she asked, "Shall we walk together?" And the old curmudgeon actually said yes. Confound him! We returned to the Gray's Inn Road, where, as there was now room for us to walk abreast, I proceeded to indemnify myself for the lawyer's unwelcome company by leading the conversation back to the subject of the missing man. Was there anything, Mr. Jellicoe, in Mr. John Bellingham's state of health that would make it probable that he might die suddenly? The lawyer looked at me suspiciously for a few moments and then remarked, "You seem to be greatly interested in John Bellingham and his affairs." "I am. My friends are deeply concerned in them, and the case itself is of more common interest from a professional point of view." "And what is the bearing of this particular question?" "Surely it is obvious," said I. "If a missing man is known to have suffered from some affection, such as heart disease, aneurysm, or arterial degeneration, likely to produce sudden death, that fact will surely be highly material to the question as to whether he is probably dead or alive." "No doubt you are right," said Mr. Jellicoe. "I have little knowledge of medical affairs, but doubtless you are right. As to the question itself, I am Mr. Bellingham's lawyer, not his doctor. His health is a matter that lies outside my jurisdiction. But you heard my evidence in court, to the effect that the testator appeared, to my untutored observation, to be a healthy man. I can say no more now." "If the question is of any importance," said Miss Bellingham, "I wonder they did not call his doctor and settle it definitely. My own impression is that he was, or is, rather a strong and sound man. He certainly recovered very quickly and completely after his accident." "What accident was that?" I asked. "Oh, hasn't my father told you? It occurred while he was staying with us. He slipped from a curb and broke one of the bones of his left ankle. Somebody's fracture."
"Potts?"
"Yes, that was the name. Potts fracture. And he broke both his kneecaps as well. Sir Morgan Bennett had to perform an operation, or he would have been a cripple for life. As it was, he was about again in a few weeks, apparently none the worse excepting for a slight weakness of the left ankle." "Could he walk upstairs?" I asked. "Oh yes, and play golf and ride a bicycle." "You are sure he broke both kneecaps?" "Quite sure. I remember that it was mentioned as an uncommon injury, and that Sir Morgan seemed quite pleased with him for doing it."
"That sounds rather libelous, but I expect he was pleased with the result of the operation. He might well be."
Here there was a brief lull in the conversation, and even as I was trying to think of a poser for Mr. Jellicoe, that gentleman took the opportunity to change the subject. "Are you going to the Egyptian rooms?" he asked. "No," replied Miss Bellingham. "We are going to look at the pottery."
"Ancient or modern?"
"That old Fulham ware is what chiefly interests us at present, that of the 17th century. I don't know whether you call that ancient or modern."
"Neither do I," said Mr. Jellicoe. "Antiquity and modernity are terms that have no fixed connotation. They are purely relative, and their application in a particular instance has to be determined by a sort of sliding scale. To a furniture collector, a Tudor chair or a Jacobean chest is ancient. To an architect, their period is modern, whereas an 11th century church is ancient. But to an Egyptologist, accustomed to remains of a vast antiquity, both are products of modern periods separated by an insignificant interval." "And I suppose," he added reflectively, "that to a geologist, the traces of the very earliest dawn of human history appertain only to the recent period. Conceptions of time, like all other conceptions, are relative."
"You would appear to be a disciple of Herbert Spencer," I remarked.
"I am a disciple of Arthur Jellicoe, sir," he retorted, and I believed him.
By the time we had reached the museum, he had become almost genial, and if less amusing in this frame, he was so much more instructive and entertaining that I refrained from baiting him, and permitted him to discuss his favorite topic unhindered, especially since my companion listened with lively interest. Nor, when we entered the great hall, did he relinquish possession of us, and we followed submissively as he led the way past the winged bulls of Nineveh and the great seated statues, until we found ourselves, almost without the exercise of our volition, in the upper room amidst the glaring mummy cases that had witnessed the birth of my friendship with Ruth Bellingham.
"Before I leave you," said Mr. Jellicoe, "I should like to show you that mummy that we were discussing the other evening. The one, you remember, that my friend John Bellingham presented to the museum a little time before his disappearance. The point that I mentioned is only a trivial one, but it may become of interest hereafter if any plausible explanation should be forthcoming. He led us along the room until we arrived at the case containing John Bellingham's gift, where he halted and gazed in at the mummy with the affectionate reflectiveness of the connoisseur. "The bitumen coating was what we were discussing, Miss Bellingham," said he. "You have seen it, of course." "Yes," she answered, "it is a dreadful disfigurement, isn't it?" "Aesthetically, it is to be deplored, but it adds a certain speculative interest to the specimen. You notice that the black coating leaves the principal decoration and the whole of the inscription untouched, which is precisely the part that one would expect to find covered up, whereas the feet and the back, which probably bore no writing, are quite thickly crusted. If you stoop down, you can see that the bitumen was daubed freely into the lacings of the back, where it served no purpose, so that even the strings are embedded." He stooped as he spoke, and peered up inquisitively at the back of the mummy, where it was visible between the supports. "Has Dr. Norbury any explanation to offer?" asked Miss Bellingham. "None whatever," replied Mr. Jellicoe. "He finds it as great a mystery as I do, but he thinks that we may get some suggestion from the director when he comes back. He is a very great authority, as you know, and a practical excavator of great experience, too. But I mustn't stay here talking of these things and keeping you from your pottery. Perhaps I have stayed too long already. If I have, I ask your pardon, and I will now wish you a very good afternoon." With a sudden return to his customary wooden impassivity, he shook hands with us, bowed stiffly, and took himself off toward the curator's office. "What a strange man that is," said Miss Bellingham, as Mr. Jellicoe disappeared through the doorway at the end of the room. "Or perhaps I should say a strange being, for I can hardly think of him as a man. I have never met any other human creature at all like him." "He certainly is a queer old fogey," I agreed. "Yes, but there is something more than that. He is so motionless, so remote and aloof from all mundane concerns. He moves among ordinary men and women, but as a mere presence, an unmoved spectator of their actions, quite dispassionate and impersonal." "Yes, he is astonishingly self-contained. In fact, he seems, as you say, to go to and fro among men, enveloped in a sort of infernal atmosphere of his own, like Marley's ghost. But he is lively and human enough as soon as the subject of Egyptian antiquities is broached." "Lively, but not human. He is always, to me, quite unhuman. Even when he is most interested and even enthusiastic, he is a mere personification of knowledge. Nature ought to have furnished him with an ibis's head like Tahuti, then he would have looked his part." "He would have made a rare sensation in Lincoln's Inn if he had," said I, and we both laughed heartily at the imaginary picture of Tahuti Jellicoe, slender-beaked and top-hatted, going about his business in Lincoln's Inn and the law courts. Insensibly as we talked, we had drawn near to the mummy of Artemidorus, and now my companion halted before the case with her thoughtful gray eyes bent dreamily on the face that looked out at us. I watched her with reverent admiration. How charming she looked as she stood with her sweet gray face turned so earnestly to the object of her mystical affection. How dainty and full of womanly dignity and grace! And then suddenly it was borne in upon me that a great change had come over her since the day of our first meeting. She had grown younger, more girlish, and more gentle. At first she had seemed much older than I, a sad-faced woman, weary, solemn, enigmatic, almost gloomy, with a bitter, ironic humor and a bearing distant and cold. Now she was only maidenly and sweet, tinged, it is true, with a certain seriousness, but frank and gracious and wholly lovable. Could the change be due to our friendship? As I asked myself the question, my heart leaped with a new hope. I yearned to tell her all that she was to me, all that I hoped we might be to one another in the years to come. At length I ventured to break in upon her reverie. "What are you thinking about so earnestly, fair lady?" She turned quickly with a bright smile and sparkling eyes that looked frankly into mine. "I was wondering," said she, "if he was jealous of my new friend. But what a baby I am to talk such nonsense!" She laughed softly and happily with just an adorable hint of shyness. "Why should he be jealous?" I asked. "Well, you see, before we were friends, he had me all to himself. I have never had a man friend before, except my father, and no really intimate friend at all. And I was very lonely in those days after our troubles had befallen. I am naturally solitary, but still I am only a girl. I am not a philosopher. So when I felt very lonely, I used to come here and look at Artemidorus and make believe that he knew all the sadness of my life and sympathized with me. It was very silly, I know, but yet somehow it was a real comfort to me.
It was not silly of you at all. He must have been a good man, a gentle, sweet-faced man, who had won the love of those who knew him, as this beautiful memorial tells. And it was wise and good of you to sweeten the bitterness of your life with the fragrance of this human love that blossoms in the dust after the lapse of centuries. No, you are not silly, and Artemidorus is not jealous of your new friend.
Are you sure? She still smiled as she asked the question, but her glance was soft, almost tender, and there was a note of whimsical anxiety in her voice.
Quite sure. I give you my confident assurance.
She laughed gaily. Then, said she, I am satisfied, for I am sure you know. But here is a mighty telepathist who can read the thoughts even of a mummy, a most formidable companion. But tell me how you know.
I know because it is he who gave you to me to be my friend. Don't you remember?
Yes, I remember, she answered softly. It was when you were so sympathetic with my foolish whim that I felt we were really friends.
And I, when you confided your pretty fancy to me, thanked you for the gift of your friendship, and treasured it, and do still treasure it, above everything on earth.
She looked at me quickly with a sort of nervousness in her manner, and cast down her eyes. Then after a few moments, almost embarrassed silence, as if to bring back our talk to a less emotional plane, she said, "Do you notice the curious way in which this memorial divides itself up into two parts?"
"How do you mean?" I asked, a little disconcerted by the sudden descent.
"I mean that there is a part of it that is purely decorative and a part that is expressive or emotional. You notice that the general design and scheme of decoration, although really Greek in feeling, follows rigidly the Egyptian conventions. But the portrait is entirely in the Greek manner, and when they came to that pathetic farewell, it had to be spoken in their own tongue, written in their own familiar characters."
"Yes, I have noticed that and admired the taste with which they have kept the inscription so inconspicuous as to not clash with the decoration. An obtrusive inscription in Greek characters would have spoiled the consistency of the whole scheme."
"Yes, it would." She assented absently as she were thinking of something else, and once more gazed thoughtfully at the mummy. I watched her with deep content, noted the lovely contour of her cheek, the soft masses of hair that strayed away so gracefully from her brow, and thought her the most wonderful creature that had ever trod the earth. Suddenly she looked at me reflectively.
"I wonder," she said, "what made me tell you about Artemidorus. It was a rather silly, childish sort of make-believe, and I wouldn't have told anyone else for the world, not even my father. How did I know that you would sympathize and understand?"
She asked the question in all simplicity with her serious gray eyes looking inquiringly into mine, and the answer came to me in a flash with the beating of my own heart.
"I will tell you how you know, Ruth," I whispered passionately. "It was because I loved you more than anyone else in the world has ever loved you, and you felt my love in your heart and called it sympathy."
I stopped short, for she had blushed scarlet and then turned deathly pale. And now she looked at me wildly, almost with terror.
"Have I shocked you, Ruth, dearest?" I exclaimed penitently. "Have I spoken too soon? If I have, forgive me, but I had to tell you. I have been eating my heart out for love of you for I don't know how long. I think I have loved you from the first day we met. Perhaps I shouldn't have spoken yet, but Ruth, dear, if you only knew what a sweet girl you are, you wouldn't blame me."
"I don't blame you," she said almost in a whisper. "I blame myself. I have been a bad friend to you, who have been so loyal and loving to me. I ought not to have let this happen, for it can't be, Paul. I can't say what you want me to say. We can never be anything more to one another than friends." A cold hand seemed to grasp my heart, a horrible fear that I had lost all that I cared for, all that made life desirable.
"Why can't we?" I asked. "Do you mean that the gods have been gracious to some other man?"
"No, no," she answered hastily, almost indignantly. "Of course I don't mean that."
"Then it is only that you don't love me yet. Of course you don't.
Why should you?
But you will, dear, some day, and I will wait patiently until that day comes and not trouble you with entreaties. I will wait for you as Jacob waited for Rachel, and as the long years seemed to him but as a few days because of the love he bore her, so it shall be with me, if only you will not send me away quite without hope." She was looking down, white-faced, with a hardening of the lips as if she were in bodily pain. "You don't understand," she whispered. "It can't be. It can never be. There is something that makes it impossible, now and always. I can't tell you more than that." "But, Ruth, dearest," I pleaded despairingly, "may it not become possible some day? Can it not be made possible? I can wait, but I can't give you up. Is there no chance whatever that this obstacle may be removed?" "Very little, I fear. Hardly any." "No, Paul, it is hopeless, and I can't bear to talk about it. Let me go now. Let us say goodbye here and see one another no more for a while. Perhaps we may be friends again some day, when you have forgiven me."
"Forgiven you, dearest?" I exclaimed. "There is nothing to forgive."
"And we are friends, Ruth. Whatever happens, you are the dearest friend I have on earth, or can ever have." "Thank you, Paul," she said faintly. "You are very good to me, but let me go, please. I must be alone." She held out a trembling hand, and as I took it, I was shocked to see how terribly agitated and ill she looked. "May I not come with you, dear?" I pleaded.
"No, no," she exclaimed breathlessly. "I must go away by myself. I want to be alone. Goodbye."
"Before I let you go, Ruth, if you must go, I must have a most solemn promise from you." Her sad gray eyes met mine, and her lips quivered with an unspoken question. "You must promise me," I went on, "that if ever this barrier that parts us should be removed, you will let me know instantly. Remember that I love you always, and that I am waiting for you always on this side of the grave." She caught her breath in a quick little sob and pressed my hand.
"Yes," she whispered, "I promise. Goodbye."
She pressed my hand again and was gone, and as I gazed at the empty doorway through which she had passed, I caught a glimpse of her reflection in a glass on the landing where she had paused for a moment to wipe her eyes. I felt it, in a manner, indelicate to have seen her, and turned away my head quickly, and yet I was conscious of a certain selfish satisfaction in the sweet sympathy that her grief bespoke. But now that she was gone, a horrible sense of desolation descended on me. Only now, with the consciousness of irreparable loss, did I begin to realize the meaning of this passion of love that had stolen unawares into my life. How it had glorified the present and spread a glamour of delight over the dimly considered future. How all pleasures and desires, hopes and ambitions, had converged upon it as a focus. How it had stood out as the one great reality behind which the other circumstances of life were as a background, shimmering, half-seen, immaterial and unreal. And now it was gone, lost as it seemed, beyond hope, and that which was left to me was but the empty frame from which the picture had vanished. I had no idea how long I stood rooted to the spot where she had left me, wrapped in a dull consciousness of pain, immersed in a half-numb reverie. Recent events flitted dreamlike through my mind, our happy labors in the reading room, our first visit to the museum, and this present day that had opened so brightly and with such joyous promise. One by one these phantoms of a vanished happiness came and went. Occasional visitors sauntered into the room, but the galleries were mostly empty that day, gazed inquisitively at my motionless figure and went their way. And still the dull, intolerable ache in my breast went on, the only vivid consciousness that was left to me. Presently I raised my eyes and met those of the portrait. The sweet, pensive face of the old Greek settler looked out at me wistfully as though he would offer comfort, as though he would tell me that he, too, had known sorrow when he lived his life in the sunny Fayum. And a subtle consolation, like the faint scent of old rose leaves, seemed to exhale from that friendly face that had looked on the birth of my happiness and had seen it wither and fade. I turned away at last with a silent farewell, and when I looked back he seemed to speed me on my way with gentle valediction. End of chapter 16. Chapter 17 of The Eye of Osiris by R. Austin Freeman. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Chapter 17. The Accusing Finger. Of my wanderings after I left the museum on that black and dismal Dies Irae, I have but a dim recollection. But I must have travelled a quite considerable distance, since it wanted an hour or two to the time for returning to the surgery, and I spent the interval walking swiftly through streets and squares, unmindful of the happenings around,
intent only on my present misfortune and driven by a natural impulse to seek relief in bodily exertion. For mental distress sets up, as it were, a sort of induced current of physical unrest, a beneficent arrangement by which a dangerous excess of emotional excitement may be transformed into motor energy and so safely got rid of. The motor apparatus acts as a safety valve to the physical, and if the engine races for a while, with the onset of a bodily fatigue, the emotional pressure gauge returns to a normal reading. And so it was with me. At first I was conscious of nothing but a sense of utter bereavement, of the shipwreck of all my hopes. But by degrees, as I threaded my way among the moving crowds, I came to a better and more worthy frame of mind. After all, I had lost nothing that I had ever had. Ruth was still all that she had ever been to me, perhaps even more, and if that had been a rich endowment yesterday, why not today also? And how unfair it would be to her if I should mope and grieve over a disappointment that was no fault of hers and for which there was no remedy. Thus I reasoned with myself, and to such purpose that by the time I reached Fetter Lane, my dejection had come to quite manageable proportions, and I had formed the resolution to get back to the status quo antebellum as soon as possible. About 8 o'clock, as I was sitting alone in the consulting room, gloomily persuading myself that I was now quite resigned to the inevitable, Adolphus brought me a registered packet, at the handwriting on which my heart gave such a bound that I had much ado to sign the receipt. As soon as Adolphus had retired, with undissembled contempt of the shaky signature, I tore open the packet, and as I drew out a letter, a tiny box dropped on the table. The letter was all too short, and I devoured it over and over again with the eagerness of a condemned man reading a reprieve. My dear Paul, forgive me for leaving you so abruptly this afternoon, and leaving you so unhappy too. I am more sane and reasonable now, and so send you greeting and beg you not to grieve for that which can never be. It is quite impossible, dear friend, and I entreat you, as you care for me, never to speak of it again. Never again to make me feel that I can give you so little when you have given so much. And do not try to see me for a little while. I shall miss your visits, and so will my father, who is very fond of you. But it is better that we should not meet, until we can take up our old relations, if that can ever be. I am sending you a little keepsake in case we should drift apart on the eddies of life. It is the ring that I told you about, the one that my uncle gave me. Perhaps you may be able to wear it as you have a small hand, but in any case keep it in remembrance of our friendship. The device on it is the eye of Osiris, a mystic symbol for which I have a sentimentally superstitious affection, as also had my poor uncle, who actually bore it tattooed in scarlet on his breast. It signifies that the great judge of the dead looks down on men to see that justice is done and that truth prevails. So I commend you to the good Osiris. May his eye be upon you, ever watchful over your welfare in the absence of your affectionate friend, Ruth. It was a sweet letter, I thought, even if it carried little comfort, quiet and reticent like its writer, but with an undertone of affection. I laid it down at length, and taking the ring from its box, examined it fondly. Though but a copy, it had all the quaintness and feeling of the antique original, and above all, it was fragrant with the spirit of the giver. Dainty and delicate, wrought of silver and gold, with an inlay of copper, I would not have exchanged it for the Koh-i-Noor, and when I had slipped it on my finger, its tiny eye of blue enamel looked up at me so friendly and companionable that I felt the glamour of the old-world superstition stealing over me too. Not a single patient came in this evening, which was well for me, and also for the patient, as I was able forthwith to write in reply a long letter. But this I shall spare the long-suffering reader, excepting its concluding paragraph. And now, dearest, I have said my say. Once and for all I have said it, and I will not open my mouth on the subject again. I am not actually opening it now, until the times do alter. And if the times do never alter, if it shall come to pass in due course that we two shall sit side by side, white-haired and crinkly-nosed, and lean our poor old chins upon our sticks and mumble and gibber amicably over the things that might have been if the good Osiris had come up to the scratch, I will still be content, because your friendship, Ruth, is better than another woman's love. So you see, I have taken my gruel and come up to time smiling, if you will pardon the pugilistic metaphor, and I promise you loyally to do your bidding and never again to distress you. Your faithful and loving friend, Paul. This letter I addressed and stamped, and then with a wry grimace which I palmed off on myself, but not on Adolphus, as a cheerful smile, I went out and dropped it into the post-box, after which I further deluded myself by murmuring nunc dimittis and assuring myself that the incident was now absolutely closed. But despite this comfortable assurance, I was, in the days that followed, an exceedingly miserable young man. It is all very well to write down troubles of this kind as trivial and sentimental. They are nothing of the kind. When a man of essentially serious nature has found the one woman of all the world who fulfills his highest ideals of womanhood, who is in fact a woman in 10,000, to whom he has given all that he has to give of love and worship, the sudden wreck of all his hopes is no small calamity. And so I found it. Resign myself as I would to the bitter reality, the ghost of the might-have-been haunted me day and night, so that I spent my leisure wandering abstractedly about the streets, always trying to banish thought, and never for an instant succeeding. A great unrest was upon me, and when I received a letter from Dick Barnard announcing his arrival at Madeira, homeward bound, I breathed a sigh of relief. I had no plans for the future, but I longed to be rid of the now irksome routine of the practice, to be free to come and go when and how I pleased. One evening, as I sat consuming with little appetite my solitary supper, there fell on me a sudden sense of loneliness. The desire that I had hitherto felt to be alone with my own miserable reflections gave place to a yearning for human companionship. That indeed which I crave for most was forbidden, and I must abide by my lady's wishes, but they were my friends in the temple. It was more than a week since I had seen them, in fact we had not met since the morning of that unhappiest day of my life. They would be wondering what had become of me. I rose from the table, and having filled my pouch from a tin of tobacco, set forth for King's Bench Walk. As I approached the entry of number 5A in the gathering darkness, I met Thorndyke himself emerging encumbered with two deck chairs, a reading lantern, and a book. "Why, Berkeley," he exclaimed, "is it indeed thou? We have been wondering what had become of you." "It is a long time since I looked you up," I admitted. He scrutinized me attentively by the light of the entry lamp, and then remarked, "Fetterlane doesn't seem to be agreeing with you very well, my son. You are looking quite thin and peaky." "Well, I've nearly done with it. Barnard will be back in about 10 days. His ship is putting in at Madeira to coal and take in some cargo, and then he is coming home. Where are you going with those chairs?" "I am going to sit down at the end of the walk by the railings. It's cooler there than indoors. If you will wait a moment, I will go and fetch another chair for Jervis, though he won't be back for a little while." He ran upstairs and presently returned with a third chair, and we carried our impedimenta down to the quiet corner of the walk. "So your term of servitude is coming to an end," said he, when we placed the chairs and hung the lantern on the railings. "Any other news?" "No. Have you any?" "I am afraid I have not. All my inquiries have yielded negative results. There is, of course, a considerable body of evidence, and it all seems to point one way. But I am unwilling to make a decisive move without something more definite. I am really waiting for confirmation or otherwise of my ideas on the subject, for some new item of evidence." "I didn't know there was any evidence." "Didn't you?" said Thorndyke. "But you know as much as I know. You have all the essential facts, but apparently you haven't collated them and extracted their meaning. If you had, you would have found them curiously significant." "I suppose I mustn't ask what their significance is?" "No, I think not. When I am conducting a case, I mention my surmises to nobody, not even to Jervis. Then I can say confidently that there has been no leakage. Don't think I distrust you. Remember that my thoughts are my client's property, and that the essence of strategy is to keep the enemy in the dark." "Yes, I see that. Of course I ought not to have asked." "You ought not to need to ask," Thorndyke replied with a smile. "You should put the facts together and reason from them yourself." While we had been talking, I noticed Thorndyke glance at me inquisitively from time to time. And now, after an interval of silence, he asked suddenly, "Is anything amiss, Berkeley? Are you worrying about your friend's affairs?
No, not particularly, though their prospects don't look very rosy.
Perhaps they are not quite so bad as they look, said he. But I am afraid something is troubling you. All your gay spirits seem to have evaporated.
He paused for a few moments and then added, I don't want to intrude on your private affairs, but if I can help you by advice or otherwise, remember that we are old friends and that you are my academic offspring.
Instinctively, with a man's natural reticence, I began to mumble a half-articulate disclaimer, and then I stopped. After all, why should I not confide in him? He was a good man and a wise man, full of human sympathy, as I knew, though so cryptic and secretive in his professional capacity. And I wanted a friend badly just now.
I am afraid, I began shyly, it is not a matter that admits of much help, and it's hardly the sort of thing I ought to worry you by talking about.
If it is enough to make you unhappy, my dear fellow, it is enough to merit serious consideration by your friend, so if you don't mind telling me.
Of course I don't, sir, I exclaimed.
Then fire away and don't call me sir. We are brother practitioners now. Thus encouraged, I poured out the story of my little romance, bashfully at first and with halting phrases, but later with more freedom and confidence. He listened with grave attention, and once or twice put a question when my narrative became a little disconnected. When I had finished, he laid his hand softly on my arm.
You have had rough luck, Berkeley. I don't wonder that you are miserable. I am more sorry than I can tell you.
Thank you, I said. It's exceedingly good of you to listen so patiently, but it's a shame for me to pester you with my sentimental troubles.
Now, Berkeley, you don't think that, and I hope you don't think that I do. We should be bad biologists and worse physicians if we should underestimate the importance of that which is nature's chiefest care.
The one salient biological truth is the paramount importance of sex, and we are deaf and blind if we do not hear and see it in everything that lives when we look abroad upon the world, when we listen to the spring song of the birds, or when we consider the lilies of the field. And as is man to the lower organisms, so is human love to their merely reflex manifestations of sex. I will maintain, and you will agree with me, I know, that the love of a serious and honorable man for a woman who is worthy of him is the most momentous of all human affairs. It is the foundation of social life, and its failure is a serious calamity, not only to those whose lives may be thereby spoilt, but to society at large.
It's a serious enough matter for the parties concerned, I agreed, but that is no reason why they should bore their friends.
But they don't. Friends should help one another and think it a privilege.
Oh, I shouldn't mind coming to you for help, knowing you as I do, but no one can help a poor devil in a case like this, and certainly not a medical jurist.
Oh, come, Berkeley, he protested. Don't rate us too low. The humblest of creatures has its uses, even the little pismire, you know, as Isaac Walton tells us.
Why, I have got substantial help from a stamp collector, and then reflect upon the motor scorcher and the earthworm and the blowfly. All these lowly creatures play their parts in the scheme of nature, and shall we cast out the medical jurist as nothing worth?
I laughed dejectedly at my teacher's genial irony.
What I meant, said I, was that there is nothing to be done but wait, perhaps forever. I don't know why she isn't able to marry me, and I mustn't ask her. She can't be married already.
Certainly not. She told you explicitly that there was no man in the case.
Exactly. And I can think of no other valid reason except that she doesn't care enough about me. That would be a perfectly sound reason, but then it would only be a temporary one, not the insuperable obstacle that she assumes to exist, especially as we really got on excellently together. I hope it isn't some confounded perverse feminine scruple. I don't see how it could be, but women are most frightfully torturous and wrong-headed at times.
I don't see, said Thorndyke, why we should cast about for perversely abnormal motives when there is a perfectly reasonable explanation staring us in the face.
Is there? I exclaimed. I see none.
You are, not unnaturally, overlooking some of the circumstances that affect Miss Bellingham, but I don't suppose she has failed to grasp their meaning. Do you realize what her position really is? I mean with regard to her uncle's disappearance?
I don't think I quite understand you.
Well, there is no use in blinking the facts, said Thorndyke.
The position is this. If John Bellingham ever went to his brother's house at Woodford, it is nearly certain that he went there after his visit to Hurst. Mind, I say, if he went. I don't say that I believe he did. But it is stated that he appears to have gone there, and if he did go, he was never seen alive afterward. No, he did not go in at the front door. No one saw him enter the house. But there was a back gate, which John Bellingham knew, and which had a bell which rang in the library. And you will remember that when Hurst and Jellicoe called, Mr. Bellingham had only just come in. Previous to that time, Miss Bellingham had been alone in the library, that is to say, she was alone in the library at the very time when John Bellingham is said to have made his visit. That is the position, Berkeley. Nothing pointed has been said up to the present. But sooner or later, if John Bellingham is not found, dead or alive, the question will be opened. Then it is certain that Hurst, in self-defense, will make the most of any facts that may transfer suspicion from him to someone else. And that someone else will be Miss Bellingham. I sat for some moments literally paralyzed with horror. Then my dismay gave place to indignation. "But damn it," I exclaimed, starting up. "I beg your pardon, but could anyone have had the infernal audacity to insinuate that that gentle, refined lady murdered her uncle?" "That is what will be hinted, if not plainly asserted, and she knows it. And that being so, is it difficult to understand why she should refuse to allow you to be publicly associated with her? To run the risk of dragging your honorable name into the sordid transactions of the police court or the Old Bailey? To invest it perhaps with a dreadful notoriety? Oh, don't, for God's sake, it is too horrible. Not that I would care for myself. I would be proud to share her martyrdom of ignominy, if it had to be. But it is the sacrilege, the blasphemy of even thinking of her in such terms that enrages me." "Yes," said Thorndyke, "I understand and sympathize with you. Indeed, I share your righteous indignation at this dastardly affair. So you mustn't think me brutal for putting the case so plainly." "I don't. You have only shown me the danger that I was fool enough not to see. But you seem to imply that this hideous position has been brought about deliberately." "Certainly I do. This is no chance affair. Either the appearances indicate the real events, which I am sure they do not, or they have been created of a set purpose to lead to false conclusions. But the circumstances convince me that there has been a deliberate plot, and I am waiting, in no spirit of Christian patience, I can tell you, to lay my hand on the wretch who has done this." "What are you waiting for?" I asked. "I am waiting for the inevitable," he replied, "for the false move that the most artful criminal invariably makes. At present he is lying low, but presently he will make a move, and then I shall have him." "But he may go on lying low. What will you do then?" "Yes, that is the danger. We may have to deal with the perfect villain who knows when to leave well alone. I have never met him, but he may exist nevertheless. And then we should have to stand by and see our friends go under." "Perhaps," said Thorndyke, and we both subsided into gloomy and silent reflection. The place was peaceful and quiet, as only a backwater of London can be. Occasional hoots from faraway tugs and steamers told of the busy life down below in the crowded pool. A faint hum of traffic was borne in from the streets outside the precincts, and the shrill voices of newspaper boys came in unceasing chorus from the direction of Carmelite Street. They were too far away to be physically disturbing, but the excited yells, toned down as they were by distance, nevertheless stirred the very marrow in my bones. So dreadfully suggestive were they of those possibilities of the future at which Thorndyke had hinted. They seemed like the sinister shadows of coming misfortunes. Perhaps they called up the same association of ideas in Thorndyke's mind, for he remarked presently, "The newsvendor is abroad tonight like a bird of ill omen. Something unusual has happened, some public or private calamity most likely, and these yelling ghouls are out to feast on the remains. The newspaper men have a good deal in common with the carrion birds that hover over a battlefield." Again we subsided into silence and reflection. Then, after an interval, I asked, "Would it be possible for me to help in any way in this investigation of yours?" "That is exactly what I have been asking myself," replied Thorndyke. "It would be right and proper that you should, and I think you might." "How?" I asked eagerly.
I can't say offhand, but Jervis will be going away for his holiday almost at once. In fact, he will go off actual duty tonight. There is very little doing. The long vacation is close upon us, and I can do without him. But if you would care to come down here and take his place, it would be very useful to me, and if there should be anything to be done in the Bellinghams' case, I am sure you would make up in enthusiasm for any deficiency in experience. I couldn't really take Jervis's place, said I, but if you would let me help you in any way, it would be a great kindness. I would rather clean your boots than be out of it altogether. Very well. Let us leave it that you come here as soon as Barnard has done with you. You can have Jervis's room, which he doesn't often use nowadays, and you will be more happy here than elsewhere, I know. I may as well give you my latchkey now. I have a duplicate upstairs, and you understand that my chambers are yours too from this moment. He handed me the latchkey, and I thanked him warmly from my heart, for I felt sure that the suggestion was made, not for any use that I should be to him, but for my own peace of mind. I had hardly finished speaking when a quick step on the paved walk caught my ear. "Here is Jervis," said Thorndyke. "We will let him know that there is a locum tenens ready to step into his shoes when he wants to be off." He flashed the lantern across the path, and a few moments later his junior stepped up briskly with a bundle of newspapers tucked under his arm. It struck me that Jervis looked at me a little queerly when he recognized me in the dim light. Also, he was a trifle constrained in his manner, as if my presence were an embarrassment. He listened to Thorndyke's announcement of our newly made arrangement without much enthusiasm and with none of his customary facetious comments. And again I noticed a quick glance at me, half curious, half uneasy, and wholly puzzling to me. "That's all right," he said when Thorndyke had explained the situation. "I dare say you'll find Berkeley as useful as me, and in any case he'll be better here than staying on with Barnard." He spoke with unwonted gravity, and there was in his tone a solicitude for me that attracted my notice and that of Thorndyke as well, for the latter looked at him curiously, though he made no comment. After a short silence, however, he asked, "And what news does my learned brother bring?" There was a mighty shouting among the outer barbarians, and I see a bundle of newspapers under my learned friend's arm. "Has anything in particular happened?" Jervis looked more uncomfortable than ever. "Well, yes," he replied hesitatingly, "something has happened. There, it's no use beating about the bush. Berkeley may as well learn it from me as from those yelling devils outside." He took a couple of papers from his bundle and silently handed one to me and the other to Thorndyke. Jervis's ominous manner, naturally enough, alarmed me not a little. I opened the paper with a nameless dread. But whatever my vague fears, they fell far short of the occasion, and when I saw those yells from without crystallize into scare headlines and flaming capitals, I turned for a moment sick and dizzy with fear. The paragraph was only a short one, and I read it through in less than a minute. "The missing finger. Dramatic discovery at Woodford." The mystery that has surrounded the remains of a mutilated human body, portions of which have been found in various places in Kent and Essex, has received a partial and very sinister solution. The police have all along suspected that those remains were those of a Mr. John Bellingham, who disappeared under circumstances of some suspicion about 2 years ago. There is now no doubt upon the subject, for the finger which was missing from the hand that was found at Sidcup has been discovered at the bottom of a disused well together with a ring, which has been identified as one habitually worn by Mr. John Bellingham. The house in the garden of which the well is situated was the property of the murdered man, and was occupied at the time of the disappearance by his brother, Mr. Godfrey Bellingham. But the latter left it very soon after, and it has been empty ever since. Just lately it has been put in repair, and it was in this way that the well came to be emptied and cleaned out. It seems that Detective Inspector Badger, who was searching the neighborhood for further remains, heard of the emptying of the well and went down in the bucket to examine the bottom, where he found the three bones and the ring. Thus the identity of the body is established beyond all doubt, and the question that remains is, who killed John Bellingham? It may be remembered that a trinket, apparently broken from his watch-chain, was found in the grounds of this house on the day that he disappeared, and that he was never again seen alive. What may be the import of these facts, time will show. That was all, but it was enough. I dropped the paper to the ground and glanced round furtively at Jervis, who sat gazing gloomily at the toes of his boots. It was horrible. It was incredible. The blow was so crushing that it left my faculties numb, and for a while I seemed unable even to think intelligibly. I was aroused by Thorndyke's voice, calm, businesslike, composed.
Time will show indeed, but meanwhile we must go warily. And don't be unduly alarmed, Berkeley. Go home, take a good dose of bromide with a little stimulant, and turn in. I am afraid this has been rather a shock to you.
I rose from my chair like one in a dream and held out my hand to Thorndyke, and even in the dim light and in my dazed condition, I noticed that his face bore a look that I had never seen before, the look of a granite mask of fate, grim, stern, inexorable. My two friends walked with me as far as the gateway at the top of Inner Temple Lane, and as we reached the entry, a stranger, coming quickly up the lane, overtook and passed us. In the glare of the lamp outside the porter's lodge, he looked at us quickly over his shoulder, and though we passed on without halt or greeting, I recognized him with a certain dull surprise which I did not understand then and do not understand now. It was Mr. Jellicoe. I shook hands once more with my friends and strode out into Fleet Street, but as soon as I was outside the gate I made direct for Neville's Court. What was in my mind I do not know, only that some instinct of protection led me there, where my lady lay unconscious of the hideous menace that hung over her. At the entrance to the court a tall, powerful man was lounging against the wall, and he seemed to look at me curiously as I passed, but I hardly noticed him and strode forward into the narrow passage. By the shabby gateway of the house I halted and looked up at such of the windows as I could see over the wall. They were all dark. All the inmates, then, were in bed. Vaguely comforted by this, I walked on to the new street end of the court and looked out. Here, too, a man, a tall, thick-set man, was loitering, and as he looked inquisitively into my face I turned and re-entered the court, slowly retracing my steps. As I again reached the gate of the house I stopped to look once more at the windows, and turning I found the man whom I had last noticed close behind me. Then, in a flash of dreadful comprehension, I understood. These two were plainclothes policemen. For a moment a blind fury possessed me. An insane impulse urged me to give battle to this intruder, to avenge upon this person the insult of his presence. Fortunately, the impulse was but momentary, and I recovered myself without making any demonstration. But the appearance of those two policemen brought the peril into the immediate present, imparted to it a horrible actuality. A chilly sweat of terror stood on my forehead, and my ears were ringing when I walked with faltering steps out into Fetter Lane. End of chapter 17. Chapter 18 of The Eye of Osiris by R. Austin Freeman. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Chapter 18. John Bellingham. The next few days were a very nightmare of horror and gloom. Of course, I repudiated my acceptance of the decree of banishment that Ruth had passed upon me. I was her friend, at least, and in time of peril my place was at her side. Tacitly, though thankfully enough poor girl, she had recognized the fact and made me once more free of the house. For there was no disguising the situation. Newspaper boys yelled the news up and down Fleet Street from morning to night. Soul-shaking posters grinned on gaping crowds, and the newspapers fairly wallowed in the shocking details. It is true that no direct accusations were made, but the original reports of the disappearance were reprinted with such comments as made me gnash my teeth with fury. The wretchedness of those days will live in my memory until my dying day. Never can I forget the dread that weighed me down, the horrible suspense, the fear that clutched at my heart as I furtively scanned the posters in the streets. Even the wretched detectives who prowled about the entrances to Neville's Court became grateful to my eyes, for embodying as they did the hideous menace that hung over my dear lady, their presence at least told me that the blow had not yet fallen. Indeed, we came, after a time, to exchange glances of mutual recognition, and I thought that they seemed to be sorry for her and for me, and had no great liking for their task. Of course, I spent most of my leisure at the old house, though my heart ached more there than elsewhere, and I tried, with but poor success, I fear, to maintain a cheerful, confident manner, cracking my little jokes as of old, and even essaying to skirmish with Miss Oman. But this last experiment was a dead failure, and when she had suddenly broke down in a stream of brilliant repartee to weep hysterically on my breast, I abandoned the attempt and did not repeat it. A dreadful gloom had settled down upon the old house. Poor Miss Old Man crept silently but restlessly up and down the ancient stairs, with dim eyes and a tremulous chin, or moped in a room with a parliamentary petition, demanding, if I remember rightly, the appointment of a female judge to deal with divorce and matrimonial causes, which lay on her table languidly awaiting signatures that never came. Mr. Bellingham, whose mental condition at first alternated between furious anger and absolute panic, was fast sinking into a state of nervous prostration that I viewed with no little alarm. In fact, the only real self-possessed person in the entire household was Ruth herself, and even she could not conceal the ravages of sorrow and suspense and overshadowing peril. Her manner was almost unchanged, or rather I should say she had gone back to that which I had first known, quiet, reserved, taciturn, with a certain bitter humor showing through her unvarying amiability. When she and I were alone, indeed, her reserve melted away, and she was all sweetness and gentleness. But it wrung my heart to look at her, to see how day by day she grew ever more thin and haggard, to watch the growing pallor of her cheek, to look into her solemn gray eyes so sad and tragic, and yet so brave and defiant of fate. It was a terrible time, and through it all the dreadful questions haunted me continually. When will the blow fall? What is it that the police are waiting for? And when they do strike, what will Thorndyke have to say? So things went on for four dreadful days. But on the fourth day, just as the evening consultations were beginning and the surgery was filled with waiting patients, Polton appeared with a note, which he insisted, to the indignation of Adolphus, on delivering into my own hands. It was from Thorndyke and was to the following effect. I learned from Dr. Norbury that he has recently heard from Herr Lederbogen of Berlin, a learned authority on Oriental antiquities, who makes some reference to an English Egyptologist whom he met in Vienna about a year ago. He cannot recall the Englishman's name, but there are certain expressions in the letter which make Dr. Norbury suspect that he is referring to John Bellingham. I want you to bring Mr. and Miss Bellingham to my chambers this evening at 8:30, to meet Dr. Norbury and talk over his letter, and in view of the importance of the matter, I look to you not to fail me. A wave of hope and relief swept over me. It was still possible that this Gordian knot might be cut, that the deliverance might come before it was too late. I wrote a hasty note to Thorndyke and another to Ruth, making the appointment, and having given them both to the trusty Polton, returned somewhat feverishly to my professional duties. To my profound relief, the influx of patients ceased, and the practice sank into its accustomed torpor, whereby I was able without base and mendacious subterfuge to escape in good time to my tryst. It was near upon 8 o'clock when I passed through the archway into Neville's court. The warm afternoon light had died away, for the summer was running out apace. The last red glow of the setting sun had faded from the ancient roofs and chimney stacks, and down in the narrow court the shades of evening had begun to gather in nooks and corners. I was due at 8, and as it still wanted some minutes to the hour, I sauntered slowly down the court, looking reflectively on the familiar scene and the well-known friendly faces. The day's work was drawing to a close. The little shops were putting up their shutters, lights were beginning to twinkle in parlor windows, a solemn hymn arose in the old Moravian chapel, and its echoes stole out through the dark entry that opens into the court under the archway. Here was Mr. Finnymore, a man of versatile gifts with a leaning toward paint and varnish, sitting, white-aproned and shirt-sleeved, on a chair in his garden, smoking his pipe with a complacent eye on his dahlias. There at an open window a young man, with a brush in his hand and another behind his ear, stood up and stretched himself while an older lady deftly rolled up a large map. The barber was turning out the gas in his little saloon, the greengrocer was emerging with a cigarette in his mouth and an aster in his buttonhole, and a group of children were escorting the lamplighter on his rounds. All these good homely folk were Neville's courtiers of the genuine breed, born in the court, as had been their fathers before them for generations, and of such to a great extent was the population of the place. Miss Oman herself claimed aboriginal descent, and so did the sweet-faced Moravian lady next door, a connection of the famous Latrobes of the old conventicle, whose history went back to the Gordon riots, and as to the gentleman who lived in the ancient timber and plaster house at the bottom of the court, it was reported that his ancestors had dwelt in that very house since the days of James the First. On these facts I reflected as I sauntered down the court, on the strange phenomenon of an old-world hamlet with its ancient population lingering in the very heart of the noisy city, an island of peace set in an ocean of unrest, an oasis in a desert of change and ferment. My meditations brought me to the shabby gate in the high wall, and as I raised the latch and pushed it open, I saw Ruth standing at the door of the house talking to Miss Oman. She was evidently waiting for me, for she wore her somber black coat and hat and a black veil, and when she saw me she came out, closing the door after her and holding out her hand. "You are punctual," said she. "St. Dunstan's clock is striking now." "Yes," I answered, "but where is your father?" "He has gone to bed, poor old dear. He didn't feel well enough to come, and I did not urge him. He is really very ill. This dreadful suspense will kill him if it goes on much longer." "Let us hope it won't," I said, but with little conviction, I fear, in my tone. It was harrowing to see her torn by anxiety for her father, and I yearned to comfort her. But what was there to say? Mr. Bellingham was breaking up visibly under the stress of the terrible menace that hung over his daughter, and no words of mine could make the fact less manifest. We walked silently up the court. The lady at the window greeted us with a smiling salutation. Mr. Finneymore removed his pipe and raised his cap, receiving a gracious bow from Ruth in return, and then we passed through the covered way into Fetter Lane, where my companion paused and looked about her. "What are you looking for?" I asked. "The detective," she answered quietly. "It would be a pity if the poor man should miss me after waiting so long. However, I don't see him." And she turned away toward Fleet Street. It was an unpleasant surprise to me that her sharp eyes detected the secret spy upon her movements, and the dry, sardonic tone of her remark pained me too, recalling as it did the frigid self-possession that had so repelled me in the early days of our acquaintance. And yet I could not but admire the cool unconcern with which she faced her horrible peril. "Tell me a little more about this conference," she said, as we walked down Fetter Lane. "Your note was rather more concise than lucid, but I suppose you wrote it in a hurry." "Yes, I did, and I can't give you any details now. All I know is that Dr. Norbury has had a letter from a friend of his in Berlin, an Egyptologist, as I understand, named Lederbogen, who refers to an English acquaintance of his and Norbury's whom he saw in Vienna about a year ago. He can't remember the Englishman's name, but from some of the circumstances Norbury seems to think that he is referring to your Uncle John. Of course, if this should turn out to be really the case, it would set everything straight, so Thorndyke was anxious that you and your father should meet Norbury and talk it over." "I see," said Ruth. Her tone was thoughtful, but by no means enthusiastic. "You don't seem to attach much importance to the matter," I remarked. "No, it doesn't seem to fit the circumstances. What is the use of suggesting that poor Uncle John is alive and behaving like an imbecile, which he certainly was not, when his dead body has actually been found?" "But," I suggested lamely, "there may be some mistake. It may not be his body after all." "And the ring?" she asked with a bitter smile. "That may be just a coincidence. It was a copy of a well-known form of antique ring. Other people may have had copies made as well as your uncle. Besides," added with more conviction, "we haven't seen the ring. It may not be his at all." She shook her head. "My dear Paul," she said quietly, "it is useless to delude ourselves. Every known fact points to the certainty that it is his body. John Bellingham is dead. There can be no doubt of that. And to everyone except his unknown murderer and one or two of my own loyal friends, it must seem that his death lies at my door. I realized from the beginning that the suspicion lay between George Hurst and me, and the finding of the ring fixes it definitely on me. I am only surprised that the police have made no move yet." The quiet conviction of her tone left me for a while speechless with horror and despair. Then I recalled Thorndyke's calm, even confident attitude, and I hastened to remind her of it. "There is one of your friends," I said, "who is still undismayed. Thorndyke seems to anticipate no difficulties." And yet, she replied, he is ready to consider a forlorn hope like this. However, we shall see. I could think of nothing more to say, and it was in gloomy silence that we pursued our way down Inner Temple Lane and through the dark entries and tunnel-like passages that brought us out, at length, by the treasury. I don't see any light in Thorndyke's chambers, I said, as we crossed King's Bench Walk, and I pointed out the row of windows all dark and blank. No, and yet the shutters are not closed. He must be out. He can't be after making an appointment with you and your father. It is most mysterious. Thorndyke is so very punctilious about his engagements. The mystery was solved when we reached the landing by a slip of paper fixed by a tack on the iron-bound oak. A note for P.B. is on the table was the laconic message, on reading which I inserted my key, swung the heavy door outward, and opened the lighter inner door. The note was lying on the table, and I brought it out to the landing to read by the light of the staircase lamp. Apologize to our friends, it ran, for the slight change of program. Norbury is anxious that I should get my experiments over before the director returns, so as to save discussion. He has asked me to begin tonight, and says he will see Mr. and Miss Bellingham here at the museum. Please bring them along at once. I think some matters of importance may transpire at the interview. J.E.T. I hope you don't mind, I said apologetically when I had read the note to Ruth. Of course I don't, she replied. I am rather pleased. We have so many associations with the dear old museum, haven't we? She looked at me for a moment with a strange and touching wistfulness, and then turned to descend the stone stairs. At the temple gate I hailed a hansom, and we were soon speeding westward and north to the soft twinkle of the horse's bell. What are these experiments that Dr. Thorndyke refers to? She asked presently. I can only answer you vaguely, I replied. Their object, I believe, is to ascertain whether the penetrability of organic substances by the X-rays becomes altered by age, whether, for instance, an ancient block of wood is more or less transparent to the rays than a new block of the same size. And of what use would the knowledge be if it were obtained? I can't say. Experiments are made to obtain knowledge without regard to its utility. The use appears when the knowledge has been acquired. But in this case, if it should be possible to determine the age of any organic substance by its reaction to X-rays, the discovery might be found of some value in legal practice, as in demonstrating a new seal in an old document, for instance. But I don't know whether Thorndyke has anything definite in view. I only know that the preparations have been on a most portentous scale. How do you mean? In regard to size, when I went into the workshop yesterday morning, I found Polton erecting a kind of portable gallows about 9 feet high, and he had just finished varnishing a pair of enormous wooden trays, each over 6 feet long. It looked as if he and Thorndyke were contemplating a few private executions with subsequent post-mortems on the victims.
What a horrible suggestion!
So Polton said, with his quaint crinkly smile, but he was mighty close about the use of the apparatus all the same. I wonder if we shall see anything of the experiments when we get there. This is Museum Street, isn't it? Yes. As she spoke, she lifted the flap of one of the little windows in the back of the cab and peered out. Then, closing it with a quiet, ironic smile, she said, "It is all right. He hasn't missed us. It will be quite a nice little change for him." The cab swung round into Great Russell Street, and glancing out as it turned, I saw another hansom following. But before I had time to inspect its solitary passenger, we drew up at the museum gates. The gate porter, who seemed to expect us, ushered us up the drive to the great portico and into the central hall, where he handed us over to another official. Dr. Norbury is in one of the rooms adjoining the fourth Egyptian room, the latter stated in answer to our inquiries, and providing himself with a wire-guarded lantern, he prepared to escort us thither. Up the great staircase, now wrapped in mysterious gloom, we passed in silence with bittersweet memories of that day of days when we had first trodden its steps together, through the central saloon, the medieval room, and the Asiatic saloon, and so into the long range of the ethnographical galleries. It was a weird journey. The swaying lantern shot its beams abroad into the darkness of the great dim galleries, casting instantaneous flashes on the objects in the cases, so that they leaped into being and vanished in the twinkling of an eye. Hideous idols with round, staring eyes started forth from the darkness, glared at us for an instant and were gone. Grotesque masks suddenly revealed by the shimmering light took on the semblance of demon faces that seemed to mow and gibber at us as we passed. As for the life-size models, realistic enough by daylight, their aspect was positively alarming, for the moving light and shadow endowed them with life and movement, so that they seemed to watch us furtively, to lie in wait and to hold themselves in readiness to steal out and follow us. The illusion evidently affected Ruth as well as me, for she drew nearer to me and whispered, "These figures are quite startling. Did you see that Polynesian? I really felt as if he were going to spring out on us." "They are rather uncanny," I admitted, "but the danger is over now. We are passing out of their sphere of influence." We came out on a landing as I spoke and then turned sharply to the left along the north gallery, from the center of which we entered the fourth Egyptian room. Almost immediately a door in the opposite wall opened, a peculiar high-pitched humming sound became audible, and Jervis came out on tiptoe with his hand raised. "Tread as lightly as you can," he said. "We are just making an exposure." The attendant turned back with his lantern, and we followed Jervis into the room from whence he had come. It was a large room, and little lighter than the galleries, for the single glow lamp that burned at the end where we entered left the rest of the apartment in almost complete obscurity. We seated ourselves at once on the chairs that had been placed for us, and when the mutual salutations had been exchanged, I looked about me. There were three people in the room besides Jervis: Thorndyke, who sat with his watch in his hand, a gray-headed gentleman whom I took to be Dr. Norbury, and a smaller person at the dim farther end, undistinguishable but probably Polton. At our end of the room were the two large trays that I had seen in the workshop, now mounted on trestles and each fitted with a rubber drain tube leading down to a bucket. At the farther end of the room the sinister shape of the gallows reared itself aloft in the gloom, only now I could see that it was not a gallows at all. For affixed to the top crossbar was a large bottomless glass basin, inside which was a glass bulb that glowed with a strange green light, and in the heart of the bulb a bright spot of red. It was all clear enough so far. The peculiar sound that filled the air was the hum of the interrupter. The bulb was, of course, a Crookes tube, and the red spot inside it the glowing red-hot disk of the anti-cathode. Clearly an X-ray photograph was being made, but of what? I strained my eyes, peering into the gloom at the foot of the gallows, but though I could make out an elongated object lying on the floor directly under the bulb, I could not resolve the dimly seen shape into anything recognizable. Presently, however, Dr. Norbury supplied the clue. "I am rather surprised," said he, "that you chose so composite an object as a mummy to begin on. I should have thought that a simpler object, such as a coffin or a wooden figure, would have been more instructive." "In some ways it would," replied Thorndyke, "but the variety of materials that the mummy gives us has its advantages. I hope your father is not ill, Miss Bellingham." "He is not at all well," said Ruth, and we agreed that it was better for me to come alone. I knew Herr Lederbogen quite well. He stayed with us for a time when he was in England. "I trust," said Dr. Norbury, "that I have not troubled you for nothing. Herr Lederbogen speaks of our erratic English friend with the long name that I can never remember, and it seemed to me he might be referring to your uncle."
"I should hardly have called my uncle erratic," said Ruth.
"No, no, certainly not," Dr. Norbury agreed hastily. "However, you shall see the letter presently and judge for yourself. We mustn't introduce irrelevant topics while the experiment is in progress, must we, doctor?"
"You had better wait until we have finished," said Thorndyke, "because I am going to turn out the light. Switch off the current, Polton." The green light vanished from the bulb, the hum of the interrupter swept down an octave or two and died away. Then Thorndyke and Dr. Norbury rose from their chairs and went toward the mummy, which they lifted tenderly while Polton drew from beneath it what presently turned out to be a huge black paper envelope. The single glow lamp was switched off, leaving the room in total darkness, until there burst out suddenly a bright orange-red light immediately above one of the trays. We all gathered round to watch as Polton, the high priest of these mysteries, drew from the black envelope a colossal sheet of bromide paper, laid it carefully in the tray, and proceeded to wet it with a large brush which he had dipped in a pail of water.
"I thought you always used plates for this kind of work," said Dr. Norbury.
"We do by preference, but a 6-foot plate would be impossible, so I had a special paper made to the size." There is something singularly fascinating in the appearance of a developing photograph, in the gradual, mysterious emergence of the picture from the blank white surface of plate or paper. But a skiagraph or X-ray photograph has a fascination all its own. Unlike the ordinary photograph which yields a picture of things already seen, it gives a presentment of objects hitherto invisible, and hence when Poulton poured the developer on the already wet paper, we all craned over the tray with the keenest curiosity. The developer was evidently a very slow one. For fully half a minute no change could be seen in the uniform surface. Then gradually, almost insensibly, the marginal portion began to darken, leaving the outline of the mummy in pale relief. The change, once started, proceeded apace. Darker and darker grew the margin of the paper until from slaty gray it had turned to black, and still the shape of the mummy, now in strong relief, remained an elongated patch of bald white. But not for long. Presently the white shape began to be tinged with gray, and as the color deepened there grew out of it a paler form that seemed to steal out of the enshrouding gray like an apparition, spectral, awesome, mysterious. The skeleton was coming into view. "It is rather uncanny," said Dr. Norbury. "I feel as if I were assisting at some unholy rite. Just look at it now." The gray shadow of the cartonnage, the wrappings, and the flesh was fading away into the background, and the white skeleton stood out in sharp contrast. And it certainly was rather a weird spectacle. "You'll lose the bones if you develop much further," said Dr. Norbury. "I must let the bones darken," Thorndyke replied, "in case there are any metallic objects. I have three more papers in the envelope." The white shape of the skeleton now began to gray over, and as Dr. Norbury had said, its distinctness became less and yet less. Thorndyke leaned over the tray with his eyes fixed on a point in the middle of the breast, and we all watched him in silence. Suddenly he rose. "Now, Poulton," he said sharply, "get the hypo on as quickly as you can." Poulton, who had been waiting with his hand on the stopcock of the drain tube, rapidly ran off the developer into the bucket and flooded the paper with the fixing solution. "Now we can look at our leisure," said Thorndyke. After waiting a few seconds, he switched on one of the glow lamps, and as the flood of light fell on the photograph, he added, "You see, we haven't quite lost the skeleton." "No." Dr. Norbury put on a pair of spectacles and bent down over the tray, and at this moment I felt Ruth's hand touch my arm, lightly at first, and then with a strong, nervous grasp, and I could feel that her hand was trembling. I looked round at her anxiously and saw that she had turned deathly pale. "Would you rather go out into the gallery?" I asked, for the room with its tightly shut windows was close and hot. "No," she replied quietly, "I will stay here. I am quite well." But still, she kept hold of my arm. Thorndyke glanced at her keenly and then looked away as Dr. Norbury turned to ask him a question. "Why is it, think you, that some of the teeth show so much whiter than others?" "I think the whiteness of the shadows is due to the presence of metal," Thorndyke replied. "Do you mean that the teeth have metal fillings?" asked Dr. Norbury. "Yes." "Really? This is very interesting. The use of gold stoppings and artificial teeth, too, by the ancient Egyptians is well known, but we have no examples in this museum. This mummy ought to be unrolled. Do you think all those teeth are filled with the same metal? They are not equally white." "No," replied Thorndyke, "those teeth that are perfectly white are undoubtedly filled with gold, but that grayish one is probably filled with tin." "Very interesting," said Dr. Norbury. "Very interesting. And what do you make of that faint mark across the chest, near the top of the sternum?" It was Ruth who answered his question. "It is the eye of Osiris," she exclaimed in a hushed voice. "Dear me," exclaimed Dr. Norbury. "So it is. You are quite right. It is the Utchat, the eye of Horus, or Osiris, if you prefer to call it so. That, I presume, will be a gilded device on some of the wrappings." "No, I should say it is a tattoo mark. It is too indefinite for a gilded device. And I should say further that the tattooing is done in vermilion, as carbon tattooing could cast no visible shadow." "I think you must be mistaken about that," said Dr. Norbury. "But we shall see if the director allows us to unroll the mummy. By the way, those little objects in front of the knees are metallic, I suppose?" "Yes, they are metallic, but they are not in front of the knees. They are in the knees. They are pieces of silver wire which have been used to repair fractured kneecaps."
"Are you sure of that?" exclaimed Dr. Norbury, peering at the little white marks with ecstasy. "Because if you are, and if these objects are what you say they are, the mummy of Sebek Hotep is an absolutely unique specimen."
"I am quite certain of it," said Thorndyke.
"Then," said Dr. Norbury, "we have made a discovery, thanks to your inquiring spirit."
"Poor John Bellingham! He little knew what a treasure he was giving us. How I wish he could have known! How I wish he could have been here with us tonight!"
He paused once more to gaze in rapture at the photograph, and then Thorndyke, in his quiet and passive way, said,
"John Bellingham is here, Dr. Norbury. This is John Bellingham."
Dr. Norbury started back and stared at Thorndyke in speechless amazement.
"You don't mean," he exclaimed after a long pause, "that this mummy is the body of John Bellingham?"
"I do indeed. There is no doubt of it."
"But it is impossible.
The mummy was here in the gallery a full 3 weeks before he disappeared."
"Not so," said Thorndyke. "John Bellingham was last seen alive by you and Mr. Jellicoe on the 14th of October, more than 3 weeks before the mummy left Queen Square. After that date, he was never seen alive or dead by any person who knew him and could identify him."
Dr. Norbury reflected a while in silence. Then, in a faint voice, he asked, "How do you suggest that John Bellingham's body came to be inside that cartonnage?"
"I think Mr. Jellicoe is the most likely person to be able to answer that question," Thorndyke replied dryly. There was another interval of silence, and then Dr. Norbury asked suddenly,
"But what do you suppose has become of Sebek Hotep, the real Sebek Hotep, I mean?"
"I take it," said Thorndyke, "that the remains of Sebek Hotep, or at least a portion of them, are at present lying in the Woodford mortuary awaiting an adjourned inquest." As Thorndyke made this statement, a flash of belated intelligence, mingled with self-contempt, fell on me. Now that the explanation was given, how obvious it was! And yet I, a competent anatomist and physiologist, and actually a pupil of Thorndyke's, had mistaken those ancient bones for the remains of a recent body. Dr. Norbury considered the last statement for some time in evident perplexity. "It is all consistent enough, I must admit," said he at length. "And yet, are you quite sure there is no mistake? It seems so incredible."
"There is no mistake, I assure you," Thorndyke answered. "To convince you, I will give you the facts in detail. First as to the teeth. I have seen John Bellingham's dentist and obtained particulars from his casebook. There were in all 5 teeth that had been filled. The right upper wisdom tooth, the molar next to it, and the second lower molar on the left side had all extensive gold fillings. You can see them all quite plainly in the skiograph. The lower left lateral incisor had a very small gold filling, which you can see as a nearly circular white dot. In addition to these, a filling of tin amalgam had been inserted while the deceased was abroad, in the second left upper bicuspid, the rather gray spot that we have already noticed. These would by themselves furnish ample means of identification. But in addition, there is the tattooed device of the eye of Osiris."
"Horus," murmured Dr. Norbury.
"Horus, then, in the exact locality in which it was borne by the deceased and tattooed apparently with the same pigment. There are, further, the suture wires in the kneecaps. Sir Morgan Bennett, having looked up the notes of the operation, informs me that he introduced 3 suture wires into the left patella and 2 into the right, which is what the skiograph shows. Lastly, the deceased had an old Pott's fracture on the left side. It is not very apparent now, but I saw it quite distinctly just now when the shadows of the bones were whiter. I think that you may take it that the identification is beyond all doubt and question."
"Yes," agreed Dr. Norbury, with gloomy resignation, "it sounds, as you say, quite conclusive. Well, well, it is a most horrible affair. Poor old John Bellingham! It looks uncommonly as if he had met with foul play. Don't you think so?"
"I do," replied Thorndyke. "There was a mark on the right side of the skull that looked rather like a fracture. It was not very clear, being at the side, but we must develop the negative to show it."
Dr. Norbury drew his breath in sharply through his teeth.
"This is a gruesome business, doctor," said he. "A terrible business. Awkward for our people, too. By the way, what is our position in the matter? What steps ought we to take?"
"You should give notice to the coroner. I will manage the police. And you should communicate with one of the executors of the will."
"Mr. Jellicoe?" No, not Mr. Jellicoe, under the peculiar circumstances. You had better write to Mr. Godfrey Bellingham.
But I rather understood that Mr. Hurst was the co-executor, said Dr. Norbury.
He is, surely, as matters stand, said Jervis.
Not at all, replied Thorndyke. He was as matters stood, but he is not now.
You are forgetting the condition of Clause 2.
That clause sets forth the conditions under which Godfrey Bellingham shall inherit the bulk of the estate and become the co-executor, and those conditions are that the body of the testator shall be deposited in some authorized place for the reception of the bodies of the dead, situate within the boundaries of, or appertaining to some place of worship within, the parish of St. George, Bloomsbury, and St. Giles in the Fields, or St. Andrew above the bars and St. George the Martyr. Now Egyptian mummies are bodies of the dead, and this museum is an authorized place for their reception. And this building is situate within the boundaries of the parish of St. George, Bloomsbury. Therefore the provisions of Clause 2 have been duly carried out, and therefore Godfrey Bellingham is the principal beneficiary under the will, and the co-executor in accordance with the wishes of the testator. Is that quite clear?
Perfectly, said Dr. Norbury, and a most astonishing coincidence. But, my dear young lady, had you not better sit down? You are looking very ill.
He glanced anxiously at Ruth, who was pale to the lips and was now leaning heavily on my arm.
I think, Berkeley, said Thorndyke, you had better take Miss Bellingham out into the gallery, where there is more air. This has been a tremendous climax to all the trials she has borne so bravely. Go out with Berkeley, he added gently, laying his hand on her shoulder, and sit down while we develop the other negatives. You mustn't break down now, you know, when the storm has passed and the sun is beginning to shine.
He held the door open, and as we passed out, his face softened into a smile of infinite kindness.
You won't mind my locking you out, said he. This is a photographic dark room at present.
The key grated in the lock, and we turned away into the dim gallery. It was not quite dark, for a beam of moonlight filtered in here and there through the blinds that covered the skylights. We walked on slowly, her arm linked in mine, and for a while neither of us spoke. The great rooms were very silent and peaceful and solemn. The hush, the stillness, the mystery of the half-seen forms in the cases around were all in harmony with the deeply felt sense of a great deliverance that filled our hearts. We had passed through into the next room before either of us broke the silence. Insensibly our hands had crept together, and as they met in clasp with mutual pressure, Ruth exclaimed,
"How dreadful and tragic it is! Poor, poor Uncle John!"
It seems as if he had come back from the world of shadows to tell us of this awful thing.
But, oh God, what a relief it is!
She caught her breath in one or two quick sobs and pressed my hand passionately.
"It is over, dearest," I said. "It is gone forever.
Nothing remains but the memory of your sorrow and your noble courage and patience."
"I can't realize it yet," she murmured. "It has been like a frightful, interminable dream." "Let us put it away," said I, "and think only of the happy life that is opening."
She made no reply, and only a quick catch in her breath now and again told of the long agony that she had endured with such heroic calm. We walked on slowly, scarcely disturbing the silence with our soft footfalls, through the wide doorway into the second room. The vague shapes of mummy cases standing erect in the wall cases loomed out dim and gigantic, silent watchers keeping their vigil with the memories of untold centuries locked in their shadowy breasts. They were an awesome company. Reverend survivors from a vanished world, they looked out from the gloom of their abiding place, but with no shade of menace or of malice in their silent presence, rather with a solemn benison on the fleeting creatures of today. Halfway along the room, a ghostly figure, somewhat aloof from its companions, showed a dim, pallid blotch where its face would have been. With one accord, we halted before it.
"Do you know who this is, Ruth?" I asked.
"Of course I do," she answered. "It is Artemidorus."
We stood hand in hand facing the mummy, letting our memories fill in the vague silhouette with its well-remembered details. Presently I drew her nearer to me and whispered, "Ruth, do you remember when we last stood here?"
"As if I could ever forget," she answered passionately.
"Oh, Paul, the sorrow of it, the misery, how it wrung my heart to tell you!
Were you very unhappy when I left you?"
"Unhappy! I never knew until then what real heartbreaking sorrow was.
It seemed as if the light had gone out of my life forever. But there was just one little spot of brightness left.
What was that?
You made me a promise, dear, a solemn promise, and I felt, at least I hoped, that the day would come, if I only waited patiently, when you would be able to redeem it. She crept closer to me, and yet closer, until her head nestled on my shoulder and her soft cheek lay against mine.
"Dear heart," I whispered, "is it now? Is the time fulfilled?"
"Yes, dearest," she murmured softly, "it is now, and forever." Reverently I folded her in my arms, gathered her to the heart that worshipped her utterly. Henceforth no sorrow could hurt us, no misfortune vex, for we should walk hand in hand on our earthly pilgrimage and find the way all too short. Time, whose sands run out with such unequal swiftness for the just and the unjust, the happy and the wretched, lagged no doubt with the toilers in the ruin that we had left. But for us its golden grains trickled out apace, and left the glass empty before we had begun to mark their passage. The turning of a key and the opening of a door roused us from our dream of perfect happiness. Ruth raised her head to listen, and our lips met for one brief moment. Then, with a silent greeting to the friend who had looked on our grief and witnessed our final happiness, we turned and retraced our steps quickly, filling the great empty rooms with chattering echoes.
"We won't go back into the dark room, which isn't dark now," said Ruth.
"Why not?" I asked. "Because, when I came out I was very pale, and I don't think I am very pale now. Besides, poor Uncle John is in there, and I should be ashamed to look at him with my selfish heart overflowing with happiness."
"You needn't be," said I. "It is the day of our lives, and we have a right to be happy. But you shan't go in if you don't wish to," and I accordingly steered her adroitly past the beam of light that streamed from the open door.
"We have developed four negatives," said Thorndyke, as he emerged with the others, "and I am leaving them in the custody of Dr. Norbury, who will sign each when they are dry, as they may have to be put in evidence. What are you going to do?" I looked at Ruth to see what she wished. "If you won't think me ungrateful," said she, "I should rather be alone with my father tonight. He is very weak, and—" "Yes, I understand," I said hastily, and I did. Mr. Bellingham was a man of strong emotions and would probably be somewhat overcome by the sudden change of fortune and the news of his brother's tragic death. "In that case," said Thorndyke, "I will bespeak your services. Will you go on and wait for me at my chambers when you have seen Miss Bellingham home?" I agreed to this, and we set forth under the guidance of Dr. Norbury, who carried an electric lamp, to return by the way we had come, two of us at least, in a vastly different frame of mind. The party broke up at the entrance gates, and as Thorndyke wished my companion good night, she held his hand and looked up in his face with swimming eyes. "I haven't thanked you, Dr. Thorndyke," she said, "and I don't feel that I ever can. What you have done for me and my father is beyond all thanks. You have saved his life, and you have rescued me from the most horrible ignominy. Goodbye, and God bless you." The hansom that bowled along eastward, at most unnecessary speed, bore two of the happiest human beings within the wide boundaries of the town. I looked at my companion as the lights of the street shone into the cab, and was astonished at the transformation. The pallor of her cheek had given place to a rosy pink. The hardness, the tension, the haggard self-repression that had aged her face were all gone, and the girlish sweetness that had so bewitched me in the early days of our love had stolen back. Even the dimple was there when the sweeping lashes lifted and her eyes met mine in a smile of infinite tenderness. Little was said on that brief journey. It was happiness enough to sit, hand clasped in hand, and know that our time of trial was past, that no cross of fate could ever part us now. The astonished cabman set us down, according to instructions, at the entrance to Neville's court, and watched us with open mouth as we vanished into the narrow passage. The court had settled down for the night, and no one marked our return, no curious eye looked down on us from the dark house front as we said goodbye, just inside the gate. "You will come and see us tomorrow, dear, won't you?" she asked.
"Do you think it possible that I could stay away then?"
"I hope not, but come as early as you can. My father will be positively frantic to see you, because I shall have told him, you know. And remember that it is you who have brought us this great deliverance. Good night, Paul."
"Good night, sweetheart."
She put up her face frankly to be kissed and then ran up to the ancient door, when she waved me a last goodbye. The shabby gate in the wall closed behind me and hid her from my sight, but the light of her love went with me and turned the dull street into a path of glory. End of chapter 18.
Bet365 is paying out before the final whistle.
Check out Bet365's unrivaled early payout offer. When you bet on a team to win and they take a 17-point lead, you get paid no matter the final score. Forget the final whistle and start counting that cash. Hold up. You get early payout on parlays, too.
Download the app and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. T&Cs apply.